Welcome to another edition of Community Hospitalist Podcast. Today, we plan to cover emergency hospitalizations and adverse drug events based on an article appearing in the November issue of the New England Journal, followed by a discussion about extended prophylaxis and review of the recently published ADOPT trial in the New England Journal. So, and I have with me today Leah, one of our distinguished physician assistant students from the award-winning DeSales University. And so I'll hand it over to Leah to start our review.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Leah Bynan, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the adverse drug events. So, this article discussed that there's about 99,628 emergency hospitalizations for adverse drug reactions in the population of patients age 65 and older. And more than half of these are patients that are 80 and older. And there were four main classes of drugs which attributed to this problem. These included warfarin, insulins, antiplatelets, and the hypoglycemics. And as many of you know, these are four drugs that are very commonly used in our elderly population. So I thought it would be important for this article to discuss, you know, the clinical implications of this. And it's something that we've even seen this week on rotation. Some of the main points that I thought were important for this article were the importance of patient education by the doctors, the PAs, the nurses, the nurse practitioners, in really emphasizing, explaining the side effects of these drugs to the elderly. One point I thought about warfarin was, you know, this drug is often a problem because people have to go in and get tested at a lab, and there's a new home monitoring system, which I thought would be something practical and useful for elderly patients that they might be able to, that providers should consider implementing that in for their patients. The other key important point for this article was I thought you really need to think about where you're sending these patients. You know, when they're going to a nursing home or some kind of skilled nursing facility, you know when they're receiving the drugs, you know they're receiving the right drugs. As compared to if they're going home, you know, maybe they're by themselves, maybe they're with someone else that's elderly and a little demented, you can get into some trouble. It's, you know, it's very common for, you know, people to miss doses, people to take the wrong doses, get their drugs mixed up. So those were the key important things I thought I wanted to discuss for this article. So I wanted to hear Dr. Belanger's thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's a great review. So this article that appeared in the New England Journal went through used an electronic surveillance system to identify admissions as a result of adverse drug events. And as Leah alluded to, kind of came to the conclusion that I think if you would have asked, we would have kind of identified these as drugs that we frequently see problems with. And I think one of the things in hospital medicine that we try to do, but we haven't really completely figured out, is manage the transition from inpatient to outpatient, whether that be nursing home, assisted living, or home. And the challenges are multiple, since, as we have mentioned, each of those settings have different support systems. And and we're sending home patients high risk for having problems. So, I mean, just taking the different medicines and looking at them, one of the ones that we're in the process of working on here is the Coumadin transition. So I think that's one. And I think in terms of the home monitoring, I love home monitoring, and I think if I were on Coumadin myself, I'd want to have a home monitor. I think probably in the initial phase, I don't know that the home monitor would be learning an extra thing. So I think probably the home monitor is a good idea long term, but in the short term, I think the main thing is that the patient should be discharged on Coumadin without a firm provider to manage the Coumadin in the post-hospital phase. So that would be one thing. Now, this article didn't address specifically the transition, readmission. This was, you know, all comers. But I mean, from a transition standpoint, sort of extrapolating the article to a transition standpoint, I think that the discharge, discharging a patient on Coumadin with new antibiotics or on Coumadin and new to Coumadin is a high risk discharge process. And then the same, I think, goes for insulin, which was another one of the medication classes. So, you know, they're in the hospital, they may actually be eating more sometimes, they go home, let's say they're on a steroid taper, and new to insulin, that's another high-risk transition. So I think this article kind of highlights some of the things that we already know. And then I think the last point that they make in this article that I know you've brought up on rounds is adjusting the target based on individualizing recommended targets. So in particular for patients with diabetes who are 85, we probably have different goals than we have for a diabetic who's 55. So we've talked about that on a couple occasions as we've seen patients. And so the targets and the goals should be different. And I think that this certainly tight diabetic blood glucose control makes sense for a 55-year-old, but it may not always make sense for 85 and often 95-year-olds. So I thought this was an interesting article, and I'm glad that Leah brought it to our attention. So, did you have any other thoughts about this topic, Leah?
I don't believe so. I think we've covered what we want to.
Right. Yeah, there's a great review there by Leah. We should have her on again to our podcast. Okay, now I'll hand it over to Leah for the second of our articles. Again, kind of in the spirit of transition, you know, the inpatient to outpatient transition, this time thinking about extended prophylaxis, VTE prophylaxis for the medical patient. So I'll hand it again.
Okay, so we took a look at the New England Journal of Medicine article, apixaban versus enoxaparin for thromboprophylaxis in medically ill patients. This is also known as the ADOPT trial. In this trial, the makers of apixaban, Pfizer and Bristol-Myers, gathered a team of their investigators to test the hypothesis that extended prophylaxis for medical patients with apixaban would be safe and more effective short-term prophylaxis with enoxaparin. And they designed an international multi-center randomized double-blind controlled study that took place between June 2007 and February 2011. They had 6,758 patients randomized. Only 4,495 of those patients completed the trial. Their selection criteria included men and women greater than 40 that were hospitalized for either CHF, acute respiratory failure, infection, excluding septic shock, acute rheumatic disorder, or inflammatory bowel disease. And they had to have an expected 3-day hospital stay at least. Additionally, except for the patients with CHF or respiratory failure, the patients had to have at least one of the following risk factors. They had to be greater than 75, have a previous VTE, a history of VTE, in which they received at least six weeks of anticoagulation. They had to have cancer, BMI of 30 or greater, be the recipient of estrogen hormone therapy, or they could have CHF or acute respiratory failure. All these patients had to have moderate to severe restriction in their mobility, which they defined as they could only walk around their room or go to the bathroom, and severe restriction was that they were completely confined to a bed or chair. And these patients were randomly assigned to either receive apixaban 2.5 milligrams by mouth twice a day for 30 days, or enoxaparin 40 milligrams sub-Q every day for a minimum of 6 days. Those receiving the oral apixaban received a placebo injection for 6 days, and those receiving the injection for 6 days received a placebo pill. They had a compression ultrasound done at the time of discharge, and also at day 30. So these investigators were looking, their primary outcome was to look at death related to venous thromboembolism, fatal or non-fatal PE, symptomatic or asymptomatic DVT, and this must have all been detected within the 30-day treatment period. Their secondary outcomes included the total venous thromboembolism and death related to venous thromboembolism during the parenteral treatment period, and this was defined as day one to the time of that the enoxaparin injection or the placebo injection were stopped. They were also looking for symptomatic DVT or non-fatal PE in the 60-day period, and death from any cause in the 30-day treatment period or 90-day follow-up period. And their main safety outcomes that they wanted to take a look at were major bleeding, non-major bleeding, any bleeding in general, MI, stroke, thrombocytopenia, and death from any cause. And what these investigators found, they really didn't find much of statistical significance in terms of what they were looking for. Their primary outcome had a p-value of 0.44 and did not reach statistical significance, so they were not able to show that the apixaban patients had less VT deaths, fatal or non-fatal PEs, and symptomatic or asymptomatic DVTs. Secondary outcomes were also not statistically significant. In fact, the only statistically significant data involved the major bleeding. 0.74% of those receiving apixaban had a major bleeding event compared to the 0.19% of those who received the short course of the enoxaparin. And this was a p-value of 0.04. So the investigators with the trial, they believed that their trial was underpowered because many people didn't get their 30-day follow-up ultrasound, so they had to exclude them. And they suggested that the study outcome may have been positive if they extended the duration of apixaban for more than 30 days. They also wanted to point out that enoxaparin was administered for 6 to 14 days, and in real life, it's only administered as long as the hospital day, or as long as the hospital length of stay, and most hospital lengths are less than 5 days. So they thought that they were favoring better efficacy for enoxaparin. So essentially, what I got from this trial was that the ADOPT trial showed that extended prophylaxis really just increases the risk of major bleeding events. And this also supports two other recent trials, the EXCLAIM and Magellan trials that were done with extended prophylaxis. So I just had a couple comments to make before I hand it back over to Dr. Melendez. okay, so I thought it was interesting that the investigators, you know, made a comment that they felt that these frail elderly people weren't able to come back for the ultrasound, so that they kind of thought it was unfair that they had to exclude all of these people. They also mentioned that, you know, that they're frail and elderly, and that the ultrasound, you know, that the ultrasound was a big deal. But I guess my concerns with that statement was, you know, an ultrasound is a very non-invasive test. And the other thing is, you know, if they're not able to come back to make a, you know, just a simple follow-up appointment, how can we, you know, be sure that they really are, you know, being faithful, taking their medication? You know, maybe they're just going home and, you know, laying in bed and, you know, as we talked about in the first article, mixing up their medications and not taking it, or taking it one day, taking it another day. And, you know, my other comment was just that although, you know, hospital readmission of medical patients with the venous thromboembolism is common and a problem for hospitals, there have been three trials now speaking against the extended DVT prophylaxis. You know, and they've shown that it simply increases the risk for bleeding. So I think this really defeats the purpose of what we're trying to do, is get these patients healthy, get them out of the hospital, and stay healthy. But if we're giving them a medication that's just going to make them bleed, they're going to end up back in the hospital. And I thought that was also pertinent to the comment about they thought they should extend the prophylaxis for more than 30 days. I mean, the only thing I can see happening from that is additional bleeding, more patients coming in with bleeding. So those were my comments. But
wow. It's fiery. Okay. So, you know, I think that Leah is exactly right. In fact, in this article, they grouped this trial together with two other major trials looking at limited versus extended prophylaxis for medically ill patients. And so I have, I think, a slightly different take than Leah, which is perfectly okay. I think that these trials give, taken together, make it clear that an extended prophylaxis strategy isn't going to be broadly applicable to all of our medically ill patients. So we can't take everyone we admit and extend prophylaxis for everyone. I think, though, what these articles are trying to do in group is start the process of finding a subgroup of medically ill patients that would benefit from an extended prophylaxis strategy. And as of yet, none of the trials have been able to really pin that down. The closest trial to come to that was EXCLAIM, where it looked like older women with limited mobility may benefit from extended prophylaxis. And that's taken, and these trials were taken in the context of, we know that a large portion of clots are related to recent hospitalization. We know that the presentation of these clots can range from minor to severe, and that screening strategies don't don't seem to make sense. And I think the challenge is that the same patients at risk for clotting tend to be at risk for bleeding. And trying to define a population for which an extended approach will be helpful. And then I think the last point that I think you make is that these all three trials tend to have a more extended prophylaxis strategy in their control group than we may have. So, I mean, thoughts from my perspective would be, well, maybe patients discharged home represent a different group. Do we use disposition site? Age cutoff? So what's kind of needed is a risk stratification strategy and then an application of an extended prophylaxis strategy that shows benefit to that specific subset. So I think taken together, I think that the issue of broad-based extended prophylaxis seems doesn't seem warranted at this point. But given that VTE is in large measure a disease of the recently hospitalized, the sense is that risk for clot doesn't end just because the hospitalization ends. Therefore, it sort of makes sense to try to extend prophylaxis. We just don't know in who to do it and for how long. And I think these trials get us somewhat closer, but they call for additional information to help further define that population. So, so that's kind of my take on it. And I think that, I think that it's a large enough issue that really a large-scale trial would make sense. And I'm hopeful that with the new novel anticoagulants, that they'll be searching for a market enough to want to proceed with such trials in the future. So I think my personal thing would be that we probably have to try to search for more patients to show a difference and a sicker, less mobile group. And I think eventually some extended prophylaxis will ultimately make sense in a subgroup of medically ill patients who meet some criteria. We just don't know the details of that strategy. But I agree, for the time being, it appears that a broad-based extended prophylaxis strategy doesn't make sense. Although I think it would be interesting to do a prophylaxis ends at discharge versus something else trial, even a 10-day. day, VT prophylaxis, although with the problem becomes patient numbers. So those are my couple of thoughts. So I think promise, but no clear direction at this time.
Yes, I agree with you on that as well. I guess, yeah, the main challenge is going to be, as you said, finding the right group of patients and trying to define the right amount of time to decrease the risk.
All right, so to wrap things up, the question I always like to think about is how are these two articles going to change your practice? If at all.
Well, the adverse drug event article, I think will definitely keep me thinking about, you know, where I'm sending the patient, you know, who's going home with them, who's making sure that they understand the medications. And I guess just giving that more thought than I did prior to this week. So I think that's a valuable thing to take home. And as far as the VTE prophylaxis, I can't say now that it would change anything I would do based on the studies, but I'm definitely going to, you know, keep an eye out for this and keep looking for new articles and new studies. Hopefully, you know, we'll be able to figure out a way to decrease that risk in our hospitalized patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the first article highlights something we already know, which is that these are risk categories of drugs that require a strong transition planning. But you know, the insulin one, I think, is one that I'll pay more attention to, that I probably focused on the anticoagulation, but not as much on the insulin and focus on checking the blood sugars, that type of thing. So realizing that those patients may require closer follow-up. So that was my point. And then on the extended prophylaxis, I frankly don't know exactly what to do clinically with the articles as given. I guess I think that for some patients who've been hospitalized and have multiple risk factors for VTE, that I think that an extended prophylaxis strategy, perhaps when they are at a rehab center, may make sense on a clinical judgment type of basis. But there's really no clear direction right now, and so I think you're right. We hope for more information to clarify the situation in the future. Well, that does it for this issue of Community Hospitalist Podcast. Thank you all for your time today, and I want to thank Mia for her participation in this podcast. We'll definitely have to have her back on future podcasts. And if there are any questions, feel free to email me, dan.fulianciusvalianciusat gmail.com.